I remember being very frustrated, but I don't remember feeling that they were denying me my rights, because I didn't have rights. After half an hour, some of the women started coming downstairs.
Wow.
And sitting downstairs, because it was ludicrous. There was I, doing a bit on the beamer, having to go upstairs to the women's gallery. And by the third year, it had stopped. The men and women were mixed on the high holy days.
Rabbling on. Rabbling on.
Welcome back to Rabbiting On. Hi,
good
everyone.
Morning. Hi, good morning.
Tuesday next week is International Women's Day, when we're going to globally celebrate all women with an acknowledgement that still in 2022, misogyny and vast and often systemic inequalities persist through the fabric of society. In so many ways, we do live in a kinder, more equitable world, yet there's still so much to do, really, to dismantle the conscious and unconscious biases that oppress women and impact on their lives professionally, publicly, privately, spiritually, you name it. As women, we live that reality every day, but I don't know if we would be here together speaking like this if it weren't for those who have worked so hard to bring us to a place when, in this and many countries, it's normal, if not always easy, for a woman to be a rabbi. And as we know, we've spoken about it a couple of episodes back. This year, the Movement for Reform Judaism is celebrating 80 years of progressive and disruptive form of Judaism, which our sacred texts speak to us in a way which is more egalitarian. We choose radical midrashim, ways of upholding and interpreting our texts, and we've built beautiful, diverse, inclusive communities that inspire, love, and include. And this year particularly marks a milestone that is a testament to that progress, as it's 50 years, which in some ways is no time at all, since 1972, when Rabbi Sally Priesand was ordained by Hebrew Union College as the first woman rabbi in the US. And just a few years later, over here in the UK, another woman made history when she was ordained as the UK's first woman rabbi. And she is still a working rabbi and mother of the Beit Din, and works very closely with all of us and is a great help to me personally when I message you with lots of different questions about various bits of Jewish law. And you're here with us today. So I'm delighted to welcome you to Rabbiting On, Rabbi Jackie Tabak. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. I'm honoured to be here.
It's our honour. We've been looking forward to this and talking about it quite a bit, sharing stories. We've all got these stories. Let's just get out our funniest moment that would only happen to a woman in this role. Debbie, why don't you kick us off?
On my very first High Holy Days as a student rabbi, I was sent out, as we are, to a far-flung small community with no rabbi. I will not name them, but they know who they are. In fact, they cheered at this story when they heard it. So it was Yom Kippur, and I'd spent a lot of time preparing. I'd, you know, brought a new dress and really gone through all the liturgy, and I'd spent hours poring over my sermons and really feeling like I could do it, but it was nerve-wracking. And as I came off the bimmer, of course, everyone... pre-pandemic times, we were hugging and kissing and saying hello and, you know, wishing each other Tzom Kal, easy fast. And a lovely elderly gentleman came over to greet me and placed his hand on my bottom and gave me a kiss on the cheek and said, "Ah, it is nice to have somewhat pretty to look at on Bimmer." The Bimmer is the pulpit where we lead from. And I think I blurted out something along the lines of, "I think you might not have been quite in the Yom Kippur mood, sir." Might have been not where we wanted to be, but that was fun.
That's one word for it. Jackie, I'm sure you have a long list of stories and moments, but do you want to pick out one for us now?
Yeah, I was at a big synagogue and I had done the Torah breakfast first at 9:30. Then I'd done the children's service at 11, which meant that just around 11:30, 11:35, I had to rush down to the main synagogue to read Torah and give a sermon. I go into Kiddush afterwards when everyone is greeting each other, and this lovely woman comes over to me and, out of love, says to me, "I don't know how you managed to work with two little children.
Mm.
No wonder you can't get to shul until 11:30.
Yeah. There's a lot of layers to that, isn't it, of all the different assumptions? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mine is kind of similar to Debbie's, actually. I was new to Manchester being a rabbi. And as I always say, it was only in coming to Manchester that I realised I was a woman rabbi, if that makes sense. Because in London, there's so many of us. And, you know, there was no glass ceiling. I went to all girls schools and unis and just felt like it wasn't an issue, that the world was open to me. And it was only when I came to Manchester, everyone kept pointing out I was a woman and a rabbi. And it became an issue. So it's kind of, so I went to one of my first shivers in a house in North Manchester and walked in, and there was a group of men at the front, because sometimes in Manchester spaces at shivers, they still separate. And I had to say, you know, intergenders. And I'm like, you can come together, it's fine. They were all sat there and they said, "Oh, I've never seen a rabbi that looks like you before. You're the best looking rabbi I've ever seen." And I was like, well, I'm not going to tell the other rabbis that. But Agreed. It was just very disconcerting. Yeah, rude to them. Miriam, you've got some corkers. Tell us one of yours.
I have. I feel like it could go everywhere. But I also realise that, like, I've heard Jackie tell that story before, and I realise it sits on my shoulder a little bit. And often I'll get up onto the bima to start and in a kind of defensive way, explain where I've been in that kind of way of like, it's not that I've, you know, been taking a break or taking it easy. And it's amazing how much of that stuff you kind of subconsciously carry with you. But I think my favourite is one where we were taking the synagogue kindergarten on a trip to a Jewish care home to do that whole, you know, singing songs. And then I was going to do Kiddush for them. And there was an elderly resident of the care home who immediately came over and started flirting with me. And, you know, you can break me out of here. I'll come home to your house for Friday night dinner. That, you know, it was a whole take me home. I'd make a very nice husband for you type kind of vibe going on. You're so beautiful, you'd make a lovely wife, all of that kind of thing. And eventually he says to me, so which one of the children here is yours? And I say, oh, actually, none of them are mine. I'm here as the rabbi of the synagogue. And he just went, oh, I'm so sorry. How embarrassing. I thought you were a woman.
I don't know why, but that's reminded me of an experience very, very recently when I went to drop a baby bag off at a congregant's house. We deliver little packages, and Dad opened the door thinking it was Amazon, only wearing his boxer shorts. It's the rabbi!
I dropped a Torah round to a bar mitzvah family for a lockdown bar mitzvah to a boxer shorts clad dad as well.
I feel like Manchester needs to up their game. That's never happened to me.
Oh, I'm sorry, Robin.
Yeah. I could honestly hear you tell that story, Miriam, again and again. I think it's so funny. And it, again, all the stories, I mean, there's a lot of depth to them, really, isn't it? About the assumptions, about what we have to do to prove ourselves in a space. I often think that when I've done a funeral and there are people who are not from the Reform space and people come up and they're so effusive, "You're wonderful, you're amazing, my gosh." And that is a form of misogyny deep down, because it's just they didn't expect it. A young woman standing and doing a good job was just really unbelievable to them. We'll delve in more deeply.
This is going to be the one where we all talk over each other, because there's just it's
so much to say.
So many stories. But there, for so many funerals, for the first number of years in the rabbinate, I would always wear a gown in that funeral space as the only really time I would wear it, but just to mark me out as the person who was leading the funeral. Because so often, even in a gown and a kippah, people would come up to me after the funeral and say, "It's just so wonderful that they've got a grandchild that's able to speak so eloquently." And it's like, oh gosh, you didn't even pick up on the fact I was the rabbi because of what I look like. You just assumed I was the grandchild. Nice.
Yeah. So the reason this is all possible for all the women who have made a path, although we struggle, the struggle must have been so real when you started out. So Jackie, can you just tell us about what brought you into the rabbinate and how did you do it? What happened? Tell us your story.
When people ask me why I became a rabbi, I think psychologically and very deep down, it was a response to the fact that my dad died when I was very young. He died when I was 8. I was convinced that that the death was my fault, as many children, I think, do. I think that I looked to religion to try and sort myself out. So I became very involved in synagogue. We joined the Reform Synagogue in Ilford, and I became, by just force of circumstance, the youngest member of the choir. So, of course, I went to synagogue regularly, and I was very lucky because I had inspirational rabbis. You know, Rabbi Alan Miller, he was superb. I actually embarrassed the poor guy. He gave a sermon one day on people should ask when they don't understand what's going on. And the next week he gave a sermon and mentioned the word brothel. So after the service, I went to him and said, "What's a brothel?" And I probably wouldn't remember this incident, but for the fact that he wouldn't tell me. He sent me to ask my mum. And then we had Rabbi Dov Marmor. So I had really incredible rabbis. Another strand was that I went to Zionist youth stuff early on, but in the Reform progressive world, I joined WUPSHES, which was the World Union for Progressive Judaism Youth Section, which is why we called it WUPSHES. And WUPSHES at that time had produced numbers of progressive rabbis. You know, I was the last one in many ways, as that group gradually folded. But, you know, Rabbi Jonathan Magnet had come through it, all sorts of rabbis had come through that group. I became entranced by Jewish learning. All these lovely student rabbis kept coming to this group, and I wanted to teach, or maybe I wanted to be a social worker. I wasn't sure. And if I taught, I didn't know which age group I wanted to teach, because I love all teaching all age groups as it happens. And gradually, I thought, well, maybe if I go into Jewish teaching, I can do that. And at least I can learn. So that's why I ended up applying to the college. But I didn't apply to become a rabbi. And that was my problem.
When I started to think about being a rabbi, we had student rabbi Kathleen Middleton at that point came to the Jackson's Row, Ellie Tikvasera. So I started to see, oh, it's possible. Did you have female Jewish teachers during that period? Because the ones you mentioned are all men. I'm just really interested in like the role models and then the possibility that was before you.
I had, at that point, no Jewish women models. Wow. You know, I hadn't heard of Sally Priestson.
Yeah.
I certainly hadn't heard of Regina Jonas.
Mm-hmm. Well, no one did until the 1990s.
That's
an astonishing
right.
story.
Way we should after. Say, let's say who she is.
Well, the first woman rabbi, really, in Europe.
Yeah.
And I hadn't even heard of Lily Montague. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'd been brought up in a liberal synagogue, maybe I would have known a bit about her. Though she wasn't well known in that period either. She'd been forgotten as well. You know, I think in general, women who had done and had been out there in the forefront of change largely get forgotten very quickly.
Yeah. And that forgetting with Regina Jonas is an incredibly troubling part of her story in a way.
Absolutely.
So for those who don't know, Regina Jonas was ordained in 1935 in Germany. She'd studied at the Hochschule für das Wissenschaft des Judentums, which was the training seminary of Berlin. And her Talmud professor had been willing to ordain her, but sadly he died 2 months before the decision was taken. And then no one was willing to do it. So she was actually ordained privately some years later, I think by Max Dienemann, who was the head of the Liberal Association of Rabbis. And she wasn't given any role in the pulpit until all the male rabbis of Berlin had been deported. And then suddenly they found roles for her. And sadly, she perished in Auschwitz, I think in 1944 or 45.
44.
And what's astonishing is that this story wasn't told. We know that Viktor Frankl worked with her in Theresienstadt. He never mentions her. We know that Leo Beck knew her from the Hochschule, never mentions her. The way we found out about her was in the 1990s when the Berlin Wall had come down. There was a woman researching Christian ordination of women and uncovered an archive that Regina herself had stored before she was deported, which contained a photo of her ordination day, a copy of her rabbinic thesis. But you'd already been a rabbi for almost 25 years by that point.
That's right.
And it's an astonishing, why would nobody have spoken about her until that point?
It really made, in particular, Rabbi Leo Beck fall in my estimation, my you know, how he worked with her also in duration stat. And how could a man of that stature somehow feel threatened, maybe, by a woman that he doesn't mention her? It's really
in 1998, there was a beautiful book that I absolutely love called Hear Our Voice, which was a collection of women rabbis' essays. And I think I was 18 when it came out, and it was a real inspiration.
Don't do that
to me.
Please, Debbie.
Oh, I got it for my bat mitzvah, if that makes sense.
Oh, Robin!
Sorry, Jackie.
And of course, I had grown up only seeing women rabbis in my synagogue. So I really had the opposite experience of incredible female role models. But your chapter in that book, Jackie, was I didn't want to be the first.
Yes.
And of course, for us, we're so glad and grateful that you were. Do you have any kind of, since 1998, do you feel like you feel any gratitude for being the first now? Or is it all, you know, I wish there'd been women who I could have followed as we've been able to, as we've had the blessing to?
Do you know, it never comes into my mind very much that I was the first, I hate to say. I never played on it very much in those early years, certainly. In fact, I didn't really play on it until much, much, much later. I wanted to be seen as a rabbi. Mm-hmm. You know, not as a woman rabbi. So I went through college wanting to teach and to learn. It was Rabbi Louis Jacobs who persuaded me to accept smicha, ordination. You know, I was doing my thesis on a Sufi, the babies who are left and abandoned, was my halakhic thesis. We had to do a halakhic thesis, and we had to do anything that we fancied as well, you know, something else. It was interesting because one of the things I think that was very clear to me was I had to do everything that was asked of me at the college. Mm. I was the only student at that point who fulfilled every academic challenge that was thrown at us. Yes? I worked at West London Synagogue as their educational director from the second year I was in college, because I didn't get a grant. I wasn't given a grant till the second year because I hadn't promised I was going to be a rabbi. So the first year I was incredibly poor. I mean, I had holes in my shoes that I stuffed with paper because I couldn't afford a new pair of shoes. You know, and I go shopping. Can you imagine? You go shopping in a supermarket and you make sure that what you're buying doesn't cost more than a pound. Mm. Yes? I mean, obviously a pound was worth more, but you can imagine, yes? I was incredibly poor, but I worked for West London, and I did about 30, 35 hours work a week for West London. And on top of that, I did all the college stuff, and I handed in every essay on time.
Yeah.
And I did two theses, which most people didn't do because that was what you were supposed to do. And I think that was the weight on me.
Yeah.
There's an extraordinary piece for me about how you bring about change. That actually what you managed very kind of quietly and in your own way was a cultural shift. That thing of, well, we're not accepting women into the rabbinate. We've ordained Jackie because look how much she knows. Look how suitable a candidate she is. You know, nobody can deny that. And there's a difference between people who do that and people who kind of go in blazing a trail and waving a flag. And, you know, sometimes that's the way that you get more recognition for the change you've brought about. And yet sometimes you make it even harder for those people that kind of come after you. I think you paved this beautiful path for us in a way that certainly, you know, I have always taken for granted, you know, in a really unfair way. Sadly, you know, it wasn't long before I was born that you were ordained, like literally a few years before I was born.
I've known you since before you were born, Minnie.
Exactly, exactly. And yet you created a culture in which it was, for me, there was no sense that I was going to be a woman rabbi. I was only ever going to be a rabbi who happened to be a woman. And I know that, you know, Rabbi Sheila Shulman, for instance, she said to me, you're not a woman rabbi, you're an honorary man. Because for her, I wasn't pushing boundaries. I wasn't fighting. I wasn't disrupting. I just happened to want to do this. But now hearing your story, I understand that's actually the path that you laid for me. That sense of just go and be you.
I don't like rows. Yes, my husband will tell you. It's very annoying. I rarely have an argument with someone. I find that you can achieve far more, usually, quietly. It was interesting talking about cultural change. I served as a student at West London the entire time because no other congregation would take me on. The first year, the High Holy Days, the men and women at the synagogue sat separately. Women upstairs in the women's gallery, men downstairs. The second year, I was allowed to read a little bit of the service.
Gosh.
I wasn't allowed to do much more than that. And then you see the women beginning to come downstairs. The rule was, if you didn't take up the seat that you have as, you know, you rent a seat at the main synagogue. That's one of the ways they earn, you know, get money. And it's only at the High Holy Days that this system works. But if after half an hour you haven't claimed your seat, then other people can use it. So after half an hour, some of the women started coming downstairs.
Wow.
And sitting downstairs. Because it was ludicrous. There was I, doing a bit on the beamer, having to go upstairs to the women's gallery, right at the top of the women's gallery I used to sit, because I thought, you know, why not? You can see the whole place. It was amazing. And by the third year, it had stopped. The men and women were mixed on the High Holy Days.
Amazing story.
I had no idea about that.
You know, that's cultural change. And the other cultural change at West London was that when I began there, the majority of the B'nai Mitzvah were B'nai Mitzvah. They were boys of 13. Very rarely did a girl have a bat mitzvah, very rarely. By the time I'd been there, you know, 10 years or so, it was equal numbers.
Wow. And that's the true success.
These were not decisions that were like arguments at council meetings and whatever the equivalent of the ritual rites and practices committee. This was just a gradual, you know, let's see what happens.
The trouble was that they did not employ me as a rabbi. Mm. They employed me as an educational director.
Mm.
And it was only several years later that they employed me as a rabbi, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I joked, you know, does that mean you have to listen to my sermons now? And the dead that I buried remain buried. I tried to do things with jokes rather than arguments. Mm-hmm. But that had to go to council. And if you think how it was, before I was ordained, the last year as a student, I had never really taken High Holy Day services. Just did it not a bit, not even preached, because I wasn't allowed. So I asked Rabbi Grin, and it wasn't possible at West London. So I actually, much to his annoyance, I was allowed to do children's services, of course, all, because that's for a woman. I went off and did West Central Liberal Synagogue services for that for the High Holy Days, because it was the only way I was going to get that experience. But the next year, when I was back at West London, after I had been ordained, I was not allowed to do anything. You know, the tiny little bit, as I said, in the service, but not a real bit. And then I was sitting in the overflow service, which I much preferred, because the people who were regulars went to the overflow service, so all my friends were there. So I went to the overflow service, having done the children's service, and the bit I was allowed at West London on Yom Kippur, Rabbi Lionel Blue, just such an amazing person, as you all know, they sent a message to me halfway through the afternoon. Rabbi Blue is not feeling well. Can you come and take over? Now, of course, I hadn't prepared it.
Oof.
Yes.
Terrifying.
Right. And I'm sure that he didn't feel well diplomatically.
Mm. Wow.
Amazing. That's what you need from colleagues.
That allowed me to take part of a substantial part of a Yom Kippur service at West London. And then the next year, it was already normal.
It's striking just how much has changed in 50 years, that when I started at Liebeck College, I don't think I had any idea that it wasn't an equal playing field for men and women. Of course, I discovered at the college that there were still things
Absolutely.
To be done. Although since 2009, when I was ordained, we now have had women in the top posts of the two biggest synagogues in the liberal and reform movements. We now have a woman who has been a head of the reform movement. We have a woman who is the first head of a progressive rabbinical college. And we have the first female head of our Bet Din. All these sort of glass ceiling moments. And I just wanted to share a kind of very recent story of allyship that sort of reminds me of what you were saying about Lionel. A couple of episodes ago, I shared a story about a family who had asked for a male rabbi, very embarrassed, asked for a male rabbi for an elderly parent. And I had been the only rabbi around that weekend. And I said on Rabbiting On that, you know, we talked about maybe trying to hire someone for them. And when my colleague, Rabbi Mark Goldsmith, listened to Rabbiting On, he was horrified. He said, "Debbie, we wouldn't hire someone in. You're a woman rabbi. You're a rabbi. You are our rabbi. If someone doesn't want you, then that's a problem for them. It's not our problem as a synagogue. You are a fantastic rabbi," and they would have whoever the rabbi is on that day. Like you, Jackie, I always try and avoid an argument and go softly, softly, and, you know, want to try and accommodate people and look after them, particularly around bereavement. But actually, sure. Mark's allyship quite rightly says, if you only want a male rabbi and not a woman rabbi, that's like phoning the synagogue and saying, "I want the white rabbi and not the black rabbi." It's a protective characteristic, and there's no way you can do that. That's not our values, and that's not okay. And for me, it was so affirming to have that allyship in my home and around me that I wouldn't necessarily stick up for myself, but I know that, you know, Lionel did it for you and Mark is doing it. I'm sure we've all had experiences of that kind of allyship.
Well, I think that, for me, that's such an important point, because I think that there is a lot at the present that we need to keep doing, because misogyny is so part of our society. It's within me in some ways. You know, I don't always see it in front of me because we're in a society that is misogynistic still, and yet we've made great progress. But I know there are so many others within the rabbinate that struggle. All of our LGBTQIA members, it's still incredibly hard. You know, I wonder whether in my position, if I was gay, would I have got my job? I don't know. And I'm really conscious, because of the things that I've seen as a woman in the role, that I have it on me even more so to make sure I'm like a very loud, vocal, proud, fighting activist ally in those senses. So I think it, as well as appreciating that from others, and boy, it hurts when that's not there, it's really important for us to step up as well for others.
I can always speak loudly for others. I find it difficult doing it for myself.
Right. Absolutely. You know. And I was going to say, I think our male colleagues are often better at recognising those moments than we are for ourselves or for, you know, for each other. I think, you know, we've got a female heavy team, and we love having Rabbi Howard Cooper as part of that team.
Your token bloke.
Yeah. We don't think of him like that. But, but, you know, it's us that will be like, "Oh, they want a guy. Great. Let's see if Howard's free." And Howard's like, "Really? You're prepared to just, you know, that's not right." But it's interesting that sometimes we don't see that we're perpetuating the challenges by not seeing it as a problem ourselves.
So much of what is obviously misogynistic was absolutely so normal in my life that I find it very difficult to spot it. I really do. You know, the disparaging sentences. It's just the norm, you know. It was always the norm for somebody to come up when they had an aliyah. I remember the men always thought it was their duty and their right to kiss me after they'd have an aliyah. And it, you know, when I went to my other, I stopped it because I didn't like it. But so many men feel they have that right.
You needed a pandemic, Jackie.
Yes.
That would have stopped it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a real problem. I remember I was at a synagogue event. It happened not to be in the synagogue. And a guy, I was new in the role again, and he put his hands all around my, he was a bit drunk, like his hands around my waist and all over, really. It was just awful. And it was, you know, really a sexual assault in some ways. But in that moment, I didn't see it like that. I thought, well, I can't say anything because I'm the new rabbi and I don't want to upset. And, you know, who am I to say to this guy? And am I maybe making a big deal of this? Is it a problem? Is it not a problem? And of course, it's only later you think, okay, yeah, that was really not okay. And when you tell other people, you start to realize, because we're also in that box. And that's what I think is fascinating, Jackie, when I was listening to you before, and I've never heard your story in full, so I'm really enjoying listening to it. when you said, you know, about not being able to preach or to lead a part of the service, like a significant part, but whether you were angry about that or what, because you didn't know a different model. You were in that culture as well. You were part of it, yes. Of not having examples. They weren't denying you something that was happening in the synagogue next door, for example. You know, it was a pioneering moment. And it sounds like your love of teaching and of having the skills was the thing that was driving you. Not necessarily the anger of like, this is misogynistic. You probably didn't even have that language, I guess, at that point.
No. Because,
you know, only now we're having public...
I wouldn't have known the word.
Exactly. And it's only now that we're having the campaign that to make misogyny a hate crime. I mean, you know, this is recent stuff. So it's really interesting to play around with, you know, that what we see, what we get angry with, and what we're able to see in the moment as well.
I remember being very frustrated, but I don't remember feeling that they were denying me my rights because right. I didn't have rights.
Yeah. It also didn't seem to affect your relationship like with Rabbi Hugo Grin, like you could have found it, you know, that he was representing that block, but actually, you know, you still felt that he was the ally, that he was making you the space that was appropriate at that time. It just maybe wasn't moving as quickly as you'd have liked. But it's interesting that you could have felt very differently about that space.
As a parallel, of course, I'm thinking of Rabbi Sheila Shulman, Zichrona Livracha, as I always do. And she talks about her time in the college as being the first openly lesbian, along with Elie Tikvasera, of course, and being in college. And Sheila spoke about not knowing she was going to get ordained for the whole time. And Jonathan Magnet really being a support and ally. And it's those people in power. And certainly, Jackie, you are now someone of great power and stature, being the convener of our Beit Din as
but
you
I don't
are.
Feel it.
I know. Well, I think that's part of what you bring, though, because it's part of that humility and that gentle authority that is such an amazing and important model.
Thank you for that.
We know there's lots coming up celebrating 50 years of women in the rabbinate, and there's a celebration called Holy Sparks. Jackie, do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. It's been interesting that lately I've been asked to be in all sorts of odd exhibitions. You know, there's a kippah of mine on exhibit in a Berlin Jewish museum, would you believe?
Wow.
All right. Brilliant.
I think it's very funny. You know, I had to sign permission for this kippah of mine to go to Germany. It was very odd. But I was really honoured to be part of this exhibition in HUC, the Hebrew Union College, of 24 first women. Mm-hmm. So one of the 24 firsts. Obviously, they got a lovely piece about Regina Yonis at the beginning, and then Sally Priestland, because it's her 50th anniversary of being a rabbi. And what they've done is that they've taken artists and asked the artists to look at examples of the rabbi's work and then produce a work of art. So the artist who was asked to look at mine was Sandy Bleifer. I hope I pronounced her name right. It's an amazing, powerful thing. And there's a catalogue apparently available, and you can look at it online, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's going to go into the notes for the programme afterwards.
That's right. Great. You stole my line. I was going to say, we're going to put the links into the notes. So that's wonderful. I'm really looking forward to seeing all of that. Jackie, thank you for joining us. It's just been, I found it quite emotional, actually. I think it's just been a real honour to have the time, because we don't often have the time to really talk about the stories.
Thank you for the invitation.
We often don't have the time to say thank you to you, Jackie, also,
that's
because
true.
We recognise that we are only in our jobs and only didn't feel that we had such a battle to fight. You know, we can laugh about the funny stories that we tell, but actually our life is so easy thanks to you and those rabbis that came between your ordination and ours. So many, many thanks.
Yeah. Amen to that.
Thank you for all your support over the years. I appreciate it enormously.
Love it. Sisterhood. We are going to wrap up our episode today. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And a heads up for those of you with children, RSY Netza, our gorgeous youth movement, has an array of summer programmes and it's open for booking. So just visit rsy-netza.org.uk. You can also reach us here at Rabbiting On. This is new, isn't it? By texting or WhatsApping us. We've got a mobile number, which is 07922 575583. Thanks for joining us. We're gonna be back next time talking about Purim. Yay. Bye everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.